Hello, everyone. This is Mike Rohde for the Sketchnote Army podcast. Before we get started in this episode of the podcast, I wanted to mention we've got a new clothing line we're releasing that gives you an opportunity to support Sketchnote Army, the website, the newsletter, and the Sketchnote Army podcast. If you go to sketchnotearmy.com/t-shirts, you'll see this variety of t-shirts that we have to offer. It's men's and women's cut t-shirts in 5 different colors, as well as a heavy-duty hoodie in 5 different colors. So you've got quite a variety to choose from. All the purchases that you make of these t-shirts and sweatshirts will support Sketchnote Army, the newsletter, the website, and of course this podcast, and help pay for all the costs that it takes to put these out for you. So if you'd like to go there and check it out, this is a way to support the Sketchnote Army. It's a way to make a statement about your being a sketchnoter, and these can make great gifts as well for those in your life that you know do sketchnoting and would like to have something that would be kind of cool and different that will get people to notice. So go check it out and support the Sketchnote Army at sketchnotearmy.com/t-shirts. And now, on with the show. Hey everyone, this is Mike Rohde. I'm the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook, and I'd like to welcome you to the Sketchnote Army podcast. And today, I've got my friend Jason Alderman on the line to talk about sketchnoting and all kinds of stuff. So I'm really excited to have Jason on. Hello, Jason. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you again for having me on the show, Mike.
Excellent.
I'm really excited to be here.
And I'm excited to have you here. I think we're going to have a great discussion, and I'm excited for those who know who you are, and maybe there's people out there that don't know your work. I'm excited for them to discover it, because I think it's really fantastic work, and I, clearly identifiable. When I see your work, I always know it's you, so it'll be fun to kind of hear your perspective on sketchnoting and why you do it, and what you do. So maybe to get started off, let's do like we do for each one of these podcasts, and I'll leave it to you to give us an introduction about who you are and what you do and what you're about, so we have some context as we listen to the story that you tell us tonight.
Okay, I am a designer and developer who works in San Diego, California, and I work with museums to make fun, interactive things. I work with a nonprofit here. I have been sketchnoting for, I want to say, maybe 6 years or so. I picked it up after the end of grad school, and I'll talk about that in a moment, I guess. But I also get hyperbolically enthusiastic about things, and so I'm always kind of following some kind of crazy new obsession. Lately, it's been paper engineering and pop-ups.
Interesting. And so tell me a little bit about, now that we know sort of a context, what tell us a little bit about how you came into sketchnoting about 6 years ago, I guess it sounds like.
So I actually heard about it online through stumbling on Flickr onto some of Austin Kleon's and Dave Gray's sketchnotes from South by Southwest. And of course, they attributed you. And I was, I'd always been keeping lots of really, really dense notes in my classes. And then in grad school, I started taking around a sketchbook, and I picked up a really cheap sketchbook from the Walgreens on the corner and started drawing in brush pen after reading, what was it, Danny Gregory's The Creative License, which is, I highly recommend that book. It's a wonderful book that really encourages people to keep a sketchbook and gets you over the stumbling block of not wanting to make a mark on the page and teaches you to draw in ink straight from the get-go and not really waste your time in pencil trying to make everything perfect. So I was keeping a sketchbook, and then I was also keeping these separate notes. And of course, eventually the two of them had to merge at some point in a wild transporter accident. And that was probably at one of the conferences that I was going to in grad school. I'd start having more sketches creeping into the notes. And then eventually when I discovered sketchnotes and saw that it was a thing that you could actually merge them a whole lot more fluidly, I was really enthusiastic about that.
Interesting. And
that's kind of the story. And then I started in black and white at the first conferences that I was going to with just a lot of ballpoint pen or black pen kind of sketches, and then slowly introduced color. And now I can't go back.
And I think that's the thing that when I see your work clearly sets you apart is that color, that second color typically. So it's a black, and typically I've seen magenta at least in the XOXO sketch notes I've seen. Have you, do you sort of stay with one color, or do you sort of go with variety depending on the context?
There was a while where I was picking a color for a conference and trying to stick to that color. And then there are other times where I've picked a color and tried to stick on that color for a day or a certain time of day. And that kind of helps serve as a marker in my sketchbooks, kind of like in a cartography sense. I can flip through and see, oh, I'm getting into the blue. That must be day two of this conference from this year.
Interesting. I think so. Eva Lottelam, who was on the show just a little while ago, I know she didn't talk about it on the podcast, but I know that she's experimented with a similar idea where she would change highlighter marker colors based on the event that she was attending, and I think she may also have used like Copic markers or something like that in place of a highlighter just for grays or other colors. And I seem to remember, so I know the pink, because I just saw that from the latest XOXO sketch notes, but I seem to remember that you used like a bright blue before as well. Mm-hmm. And I think we, in the sketch note workbook, we actually featured some of your work showing the, I don't know if we could show the colors or not, but I think it was in that case, it was orange because that was the second color of the book. We didn't have an option for any other colors, but I love sort of look and feel of that orange and black, or the magenta and black, or blue and black. So that combo is a really cool look. And I think what I like about it is it's color, but it's also limited or constrained in some way. You're not giving yourselves 40 colors, you're giving yourself two colors. So talk about a little bit about your sort of mindset or perspective on why you chose to add the second color and how that has changed the way you work with your sketch notes.
Well, it's funny that you should bring up Eva, because I think I probably stole that technique from her. I love her sketch notes. They're really so expressive, and they're fantastic.
I agree.
I was deeply inspired by her work when I was starting out, and also by, there's a cartoonist named Jordan Crane who published webcomics for a while back, and it was always two-tone. It was black and then some kind of one single color that was chosen, usually like a yellow or a magenta or something like that. And I've found that usually the brighter colors that provide more contrast, that are kind of a mid-tone between the black and the white, have worked a lot better for me. But it's been kind of a learning process going through that. Usually things like orange and green and magenta seem to work better than the blues and the purples.
Interesting. And I think it's sort of... it sort of sets you apart. I mean, like I said at the beginning, it's really clear when I see that work that it looks like either you've done it or someone's copying you. So I guess that's a good thing, right? It brands you as your style. And I think the style of your, or the feel of your line, the way you draw things, the way you lay out things, and yet still maintain, you know, white space in your layouts is really interesting too. Maybe talk a little bit about how you go about that, if you've even done that with an intentionality, or does it more of a, you know, that, you know, so
that is a constant challenge, Mike.
Yes.
So the I think you've talked about it in your books, how you really have to think about it before you start putting things down on the page, and I always try to kind of have a general sense of the layout of where I'm going to draw maybe a central likeness of the person or a title or things like that, and how I'm going to flow the text around that person. But then usually towards the bottom of the page, especially if the person has a really fast-paced talk or a really dense talk, there's a lot of stuff that gets kind of crammed down at the bottom. So especially in my early sketch notes, and often in my current sketch notes, it's always a challenge to try to not have it really loose up at the top and then bunched down at the bottom. And so that kind of pacing of thinking about that, I've had to give myself permission to say, okay, it's starting to get crowded towards, as I move towards the bottom, don't try to wedge everything into there. Let's move that to a second page and finish it later.
That brings me back to Eva Lotta. She said that she sort of stumbled onto these books that she used, which were square books from, I think she said, Future of Web Design or something. And they gave them away. And she noticed that lots of people didn't take them at the end of the conference. And there were these goodie bags all over the place with these beautiful sketchbooks. So she took like four home with her and started using them as sort of a, seemed like this format was nice. And she just started using it. Next thing she knew, she had burned through the four books and was getting to the end of this fourth one, and she found the company that made it and produced her own. So she got, I think, she said she calls it her lifetime of sketchbooks. So she did 100 of these things in the same typeface or the same paper, and then did her own cover. So she's got like boxes of these things that she uses for her sketches. That's really interesting. And I think I've lost my train of thought, actually.
Well, so, I was actually going to piggyback on that and say that it's always so frustrating as an artist when you find the one pen that you like or the one type of paper that you like, and then you can't find it anymore in the store. Yeah. And so I don't know about you. Maybe you experience the same thing, but usually if you find a pen, you either stockpile it or you try to buy a few ahead just in case, because you don't know if it's going to disappear. And then you find your next favorite pen or your next favorite paper. Mm-hmm. But the first time that happened to me was I was buying the cheapest sketchbooks I could find at Walgreens or CVS. And whoever the manufacturer was, I think it was in Canada, they changed manufacturers of the same brand. And then they were made in North Carolina. And the weight of the paper and the tooth of it, the way it felt under the pen was just slightly different. And so I ended up changing pens to find a different pen that worked better with that paper. Hmm. But it's funny. It's always an evolution.
Interesting. And I think I remember where I was going with our discussion and sort of bringing in Eva Lotta as well was... Mm-hmm. So what I really like about what you said earlier about layout and sort of being loose at the top and cramming at the bottom is a challenge I still face every time I do a sketch note, like figuring out like where is this thing going and where will I put things and what will I keep and what will I not keep is a constant challenge. And I think maybe that's a message that when I do my sketch note workshops and talks and things needs to be more of a keystone for people to realize, like, I've been doing this since 2006 and probably before that, not calling it sketch notes before that necessarily. And it's always a struggle every time I pick up a pen or grab the iPad and I'm doing sketch notes live, that layout is always a challenge. It never seems to get completely easy. Like you build patterns and you get better at it, I think, and understanding ways that you can do things and tricks and tips and things, especially with an iPad where you can, you know, later on edit things or move things around. That's sort of a little bit of a cheat, right? If you've got that capability. But if you're on paper and pen, it's just a constant challenge. And in some ways, that's the beauty of it, right? Like if you were able to be really good at it and do it perfectly every time, then it would sort of lose a little bit of the fun. And I think the challenge of having to really work it every single time is a good thing. Keeps you honest. It doesn't let you sort of sleep too much on that challenge. It becomes a challenge every time you do it, no matter what. And it sounds like that's true for you as well. So I think that seemed like a message and a theme that is worth sharing for other sketchnoters who are listening, that if you feel like, you know, doing these layouts or you're getting loose at the top and tight at the bottom or whatever the problem is that you're faced with, everybody else is facing that too. You're not alone, and you're not doing it badly because of it. I think that's a good message to maybe bring out of that whole turn in the discussion.
I would say that it doesn't necessarily get easier the more that you do it, but you definitely get more used to it. And so you don't panic as much.
Yeah, that's
good. You get more comfortable with the feeling. And so it kind of the way you were describing it reminded me a little bit of a game, kind of like a chess match or some kind of where you're thinking through the strategy of, okay, this is where we need to move to make this happen next.
Mm-hmm. And when you solve those problems, then there's that much more joy knowing that it's a challenge and a game every time. When you really nail it, when there's times when you just everything lines up right, it's just a really joyful moment, right? To feel that, feel everything syncing up. So that's really interesting.
And you will make mistakes every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it's how you recover from those mistakes that kind of makes you feel the way that you do about your sketch notes. Mm-hmm. So
I've kind of come to the place where I'm okay with the mistakes and the errors, and actually kind of embrace them as just part of the process. There was something, I think it was Austin Kleon in his newsletter was talking about, maybe it was him, that there was some research on, I think it was Native American blankets or something. And if you go through the blankets, There's points where there's mistakes and they just leave them in there because they feel like in that moment, that's just what the moment was. Like that just,
yeah,
that makes it real, right? It wasn't, and it was even beyond the idea that it was a mistake. It's just, that's what the moment was. Like, what are you talking about mistake? That's not a mistake. That's just what it was, right? And it, and they just move past. It's just part of the weave, right? It's part of the, it's it almost becomes in a way intentional. Yeah. And I think I've heard too, and I don't know if this is just an urban legend, that so quilts that Amish women or kids or people, whatever, will produce, they actually leave errors, or they leave it a little bit imperfect as sort of a reminder to themselves that they're only human, and as much as they try to be perfect, there's going to be errors. Even if they do their best work, there will be something that could have been done a little bit better. Or something. I think that was the intention. Have you heard that before?
I've heard something in that vein, and I should probably know this because my mom loves quilting, and I feel like I'm letting the family down by not knowing my quilt trivia.
That's but, we'll have that, to do.
There was a great quilt and color show actually at the art museum here in San Diego. It was actually out of the, I think, one of the art museums in Boston. And they had a whole ton of centuries old quilts that were just jaw dropping, breathtaking. Hmm. And I'm racking my brain trying to think, okay, what was unfinished? What were the imperfections that they left in? But
we'll have to do when I re-listen to this this discussion, I'll have to look around and see if I've got any reference on both the Native American weaving, that idea of the moment, and also if there's any kind of reference on Amish quilting, if there's that idea behind it. If there is, I'll put that in the show notes for those who are listening, so you can sort of dig that up and read about it as well.
Well, now I'm looking forward to the future.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Hopefully our discussion will provide all kinds of value to people that are listening. That's really sort of the goal of what we're doing. So I'm really curious. So you mentioned that you're a UX designer. I am as well. And I've found in myself that this sketchnoting stuff seems to leak out of me, whether I like it or not. I use sketchnoting, so I keep a bullet journal at work. And I don't do it exactly the way Ryder prescribes it. I've done a modification of it just to manage my days. And it's kind of a mix of bullet journal and something another friend, Bill Westerman, did for many years before, with this time bar that runs down the left side of the page. And then I'll typically, once I've got my task list and I've got my day laid out, there's this open space below it. And I often will draw, you know, how to solve problems, or if I'm sharing something with someone, a little drawing will get there. Just sketchnotes sort of leak out in that book. And we have these whole sessions devoted to whiteboard sketchnoting, basically, where we solve software problems. So I'm really curious, knowing that you're also a UX guy, how does that sketchnoting background impact the work that you do and come out in your daily work?
Well, my daily work could vary. It's everything from websites to designing in-gallery interactives in physical space. And so anytime that you're trying to concept something or even explain your ideas to somebody else, you have to draw it out. And sketch notes, at their very basic level, are annotated drawings. Mm-hmm. As you get more complicated, of course, you're mixing the two a whole lot more. I think that I've used sketchnoting more actually on whiteboards at work for strategy sessions, where the folks that work with our nonprofit will come in and try to figure out, okay, what's our big picture thinking? How can we make a map of this situation of where all of our parts of our business are, and what's important to those parts of the businesses? I think I said that right. But it's been interesting, and I think that the visual nature of it and alternating whiteboard colors has been able to really spatialize these things. Lynn Vizard, whose name I'm probably mispronouncing, she gave a talk at the Interaction Design Conference, I think it's Interaction 16 in Helsinki, on design as cartography. And it's a fantastic talk. And then at the IA Summit this past year in Atlanta, or this year in Atlanta, Joe Sokol gave a similar talk on design and maps and what the two had in common. And he referenced Lynn's talk. But both of them are well worth watching because they present a lot of the things that we do as in terms of cartography that are really interesting and just kind of put a wrinkle in your brain of how to think about that. Especially as we start working with more complex systems, it's I think sketchnoting is kind of a visual map of an idea space, and cartography in the sense of design, when you're mapping out complex systems, can really help you to understand the system so that you can better shape where it's going and how it behaves.
Wow, that's really fascinating, and I think it touches on another love I have of maps, paper maps. I've always loved maps. And it seems like maybe these things sort of crash into each other in ways that we hadn't really realized before. So we'll definitely link those up in the show notes. I'll be one of the first ones to watch those. Hopefully others can check them out as well. It just deepens your understanding of how these things relate to each other. That's a really
They're short talks and they're wonderful. Yeah. Excellent. Highly recommend them.
So, it sounds like that's definitely leaking into your world as well, which is really, really encouraging. I think those who I've talked to with sketchnoting, especially the ones who really make it a practice, it just sort of comes out everywhere in each one of these person's lives. So that's it seems like a common theme, and very encouraging for those who are starting to really build it up as a practice and do it every day, that you just look for places to have it up here, and you can find ways to use it. So that's really encouraging.
It also is really, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Please,
I was going to say, it also is really a great way of meeting people if you're sketchnoting at conferences, just because it's kind of an icebreaker. If somebody's looking over your shoulder as you're drawing a talk, then, or sitting next to you as you're drawing a talk, then it's just kind of the people at the conferences that we go to, especially in the UX community, are very curious, and they're also very visual thinkers. And so I've just found it's been an amazing way to make friends at the conferences.
I agree. I think that's the way I've made many friends, particularly at South by Southwest, is where I spent a lot of years attending every year and doing those sketch notes. And I know that you've made your way. And actually, that point actually leads me to the next question I was thinking about, which is the XOXO festival or conference, or
yes.
Maybe you can tell me a little bit more. I know about it. I've never attended. I always thought it would be a fascinating event to go to, but it just never lined up or worked out for me. But I know that you're a regular attender and you've been there many years.
Been there 3 of the 5 years.
Okay.
And this year supposedly might have been the last year, but they also said that almost every year. What we do know for sure is that next year they're not doing it. They're taking a year off for sure. And then whatever happens after that, it could mutate into something else. Someone described it to me as South by Southwest in the early years. But I never went to South by Southwest, so maybe you'll have to tell me if this rings true, since you've been to South by Southwest a whole bunch. I guess I should describe what it's like. It's a conference for people who are creating things on the internet. And that's a pretty big umbrella, but you've got everyone from podcasters to comics artists to musicians to vloggers to filmmakers, podcasters, all over the map of creative works. And they kind of handpick people that are really inspiring or are doing interesting things, and give them a stage and a chance to talk about what they're thinking about and the challenges that they're facing. And the themes kind of seem to emerge from these groups of speakers every year. I didn't go the first year. They did a Kickstarter for it, and it was intended a bunch as a love letter to Portland. And Andy Bayo and Andy McMillan, who put it on, really put so much love and care into the user experience of the entire conference. It really, really is amazing. So I do hope that they do it in the future. But the first year was all about being independent is wonderful. You should quit your job. You can make it on your own and be creative on the internet. And then the next year was, Well, okay, now you've quit your job. You should still quit your job if you haven't quit your job yet. And things are amazing. But we do have to take care of ourselves. And also there's, you know, some dark things that we don't really talk about how it's kind of lonely or depressing or things are stressful. And then the next year was kind of more of that of, whoa, okay, we really need to look out for each other and start to build some kind of infrastructure and take care of ourselves. And then the next year, which I missed, which was last year, apparently was very contemplating mortality a whole lot more. Of like, I had this near-death experience, or I've had these traumatic experiences with technology or just in life, and it's caused me to reevaluate what's important and what kind of mark and legacy am I going to leave in the world. And so it tends to balance uplifting talks with talks that sometimes in the same talk are talking about the deep, heavy things that we don't always talk about. And then this year, the theme that kind of emerged was talking about the taboo around talking about money and income. And maybe it's okay to have a day job. And so I've babbled on for a long time about this, but it's a really well-done conference and just a tremendous eclectic bunch of people.
Interesting. And I think what's interesting immediately that the thing that strikes me is that sort of full circle-ness of,
yeah,
hey, let's quit our jobs, and hey, let's quit our jobs. Oh, this is hard. You know, then there's sort of all the challenges, and you come back to the fifth year, and now it's like, well, maybe it's not so bad to have a full-time, you know, gig and doing stuff on the side. Like, that's okay too. It sort of expands its purview, I guess, in a sense.
And I may be finding that pattern where it was only in a few of the talks, but
That's definitely one perspective. And I think you, of anyone, you've documented these as many as you've been to. So you probably have a pretty deep feel for each year and get a sense for it. And it sounds a lot like, from what you've described and what I've heard from others and read, that XOXO is a lot like what I remembered from the early years I went South by, which were not actually maybe the earliest years. I have a friend who went to the earlier years than me. So I think my first was 2008. I think my last was 2012. So I sort of had that 4-year window, and I could definitely see the shift even in those 4 years. Unlike XOXO, South by Southwest just kept on expanding and growing like a giant. And I think, as I understand, XOXO is pretty clearly curated and controlled and limited in lots of ways. As I understand it, I could be wrong about that.
No, they took great pains to try to keep branding and marketing out of the conference as much as possible. And it wasn't that they were against having any kind of sponsorship. They just didn't put any kind of corporate logos on anything. And if they had certain things that were sponsored by folks, it was a direct sponsorship. So, for example, one company might sponsor the drinks at the even the non-alcoholic drinks at the coffee bar. Another company might sponsor some kind of movie showing that they had, or another company might sponsor the Wi-Fi or the captioning or something like that. So it was more of like a podcast ad endorsement where they read their thanks to the people at the beginning of every day or in the closing comments at the end of every day, but their logos weren't emblazoned all over the place.
It's almost like public radio type of sponsorship.
Exactly.
In some sense.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. I like that. I think, and I'm pretty sure that Andy Bayo and Andy McMillan had been to South By, and it sounded as though they'd been there in the earliest years and sort of saw that community and wanted to recreate it. So they had a sense of what they wanted to do and then just took it to its natural next step and extended those ideas, which is pretty cool.
I'm nodding and I realize you can't see this because it's radio.
So now that we have a context around what XOXO conference is or was or maybe, talk a little bit about your sketchnoting. I'm assuming that you probably had done sketchnoting and just brought that to the table. How did you feel doing it? What was the reaction? It sounds like you probably met people, judging by the way you're meeting people at UX conferences, you probably met people at this. And was everyone open to it? I think I remember an exchange a couple of years ago, and it may have been Andy Bayo, I'm not sure, that he saw your sketch notes and said, yeah, sketch notes don't really do anything for me. Or there was some kind of a discussion. I don't even know if you were in on it, but it seemed like there was someone who thought they were okay. But like, I don't know, maybe I'll just let you describe if there was any kind of what it was like. To, are most people interested and curious, or is, have there been anybody that's challenged you, or what's the reaction to your sketch notes at, of that conference?
I've probably been blissfully oblivious. my philosophy with sketchnotes is that you do them first for yourself, and then you do them for an audience. Mm-hmm. And some other people may have a different philosophy about their sketchnotes, but for me, it's more about trying to capture it in some kind of memento for myself. And the I take it as a challenge to try to make it look as good as I can. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, that means that I end up drawing a whole lot more after the actual talk is done. I think I've sent you before some pictures of before sketches and after sketches. Mm-hmm. And I managed to capture maybe 60-70% during the talk, but sometimes, especially if it's a really fast-paced talk or a short talk without much of a break in between, it's tough. But anyway, back to the subject. Andy, I got to meet Andy a little bit more this year, and he is a really generous person. So I think he likes the sketch notes. But there are also a lot of other sketch noters at XOXO. People like Susan Lin and Darby, whose last name I'm forgetting, they had amazing sketch notes this year of all the speakers, and also using a duotone in Darby's case and watercolors in Susan's case. And then tons of other sketch noters who I'm sure were capturing things and not necessarily sharing them on Twitter where I was looking. Mm-hmm. Possibly sharing them on Instagram or Facebook or other places, so, or not sharing them at all and just keeping them as their own mementos of the event.
So I'll probably disclaim that I don't know if that was Andy who was saying that. It might have been somebody else, but it was a couple years ago, and it was, and I don't think they were necessarily being critical either. They're just saying, "Yeah, it's not for me, but I think they're cool," kind of thing. Like, I wouldn't do that, but I think they're cool, which is often a can often be a response that I've seen come across in sketches. I don't think it was. I didn't get the sense it was critical at all, and I think that's an interesting perspective too. The thing you just said is exactly my perspective. Is I do it first for myself, and I try to teach that when I teach the process, because I think the challenge is if you don't first make it for yourself and just enjoy the process, then it can be like a burden, right? It can be this thing that you feel like you are required to do, especially. So I've been in cases where I've been paid to do sketch noting, you know, flown in, got a hotel, you know, I'm expected to deliver some sketch notes at the end of the day, and it's not a problem because I enjoy it and I would do it anyway. But those have always been a little bit unusual because, you know, there's an expectation that you deliver something at the end, and you might sit there and question, like, am I capturing the right things? Like, I mean, they're obviously choosing me for my perspective, and you hope that that's indeed what they are hoping for. And in all those cases, I feel like my sketch notes have delivered on when I've done that. But in some ways, that makes me maybe want to not necessarily be hired for everything, right? There might be things I just want to do it for myself so I don't have any kind of limitations or expectations or requirements set upon me to do certain things, which goes back to that principle of I do it first myself. And if somebody else gets something out of it, awesome, but I don't feel a responsibility to necessarily make it for someone else maybe who wasn't there, because there's so much of it is based on context of what you're hearing and being in that moment, right? Again, mm-hmm. there's that moment thing that other people at XO would probably relate to them at a level above someone who wasn't at the event at all, right? So there's different degrees of connection. So any thoughts about that?
Well, I definitely wouldn't turn away a paying gig to do sketch notes at a conference. Sure.
No, it's quite fun. It's a blast.
And I did have a similar feeling as what you were describing when I took some sketch notes at a conference in Minneapolis, and it was a sponsored session from Microsoft on the Kinect 2. And they reached out afterward and asked if they could turn my sketch notes into a poster. So I was commissioned to adapt the sketch notes into a poster. And I worked with them pretty closely to try to make sure that I wasn't writing anything that was A, inaccurate, and B, stepping on any toes. But I still feel like it was my work, and they wanted to represent it as such and not necessarily as Microsoft's. Mm-hmm. But there's always that feeling of, am I representing my client well enough? Mm-hmm. And a little bit of awkwardness. But the other thing that I'm going to change the subject a little bit, the other thing about sketchnoting at a conference with other sketchnoters is comparing sketchnotes is fantastic, because you notice all the things that you didn't capture, mm-hmm. that they captured, and the things that you captured that they didn't capture. And it just helps you kind of see how these other people are thinking about things when they're trying to jot down notes from a really fast-paced talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really valuable, and it's fun when I've been in events where I've got friends who are doing sketchnoting, and we all do it and sort of compare afterwards. Even if we're maybe, you know, we're not immediately able to see each other, we can come back later and look at each other's work, and definitely, you know, admiration of each other's approach. It's really fun to see that, and it sort of pushes, like if you know some other sketchnoters are there, it sort of pushes you to do your best work. Not in a negative way, but more of a challenge.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, game on. Let's do it. And because it's fun to push each other to be our best, and not necessarily to say this person's better than that person, because it's hard to judge it on that scale. Like, it's so personal and so unique to the person.
That's one of the greatest things about sketch notes, I think, is just the amount of personal style that everybody seems to put into theirs.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think it's one of the things I was shooting for in both of the books that I've done, is to load the books up with as many different people's perspectives on the sketchnoting idea as possible, so that there's no way that someone could go through that book and think. And it's interesting. I've seen some reviews on Amazon of the books, and there are a few people that'll say, "Yeah, this guy tried to tell me that his way was the only way." And I was like, "I don't know where you're, I don't know where you're getting that from, because that's exactly the opposite of what I was intending." And I don't know how you made it through, you know, 50 or 60 different people's work and came to that conclusion, because I know how many people were in those books, because I had to get all the rights from everyone to use their work, and I know that it was, and I intentionally got lots of variety. So. Yeah, I agree. I think that's one of the great things, is just such a unique variety, and each person has a perspective, and we have influences, right? Like you said, that you were influenced by Eva Lotta and Dave Gray and Austin Kleon, and we all have our influences, and we continue to be influenced. So we may not even realize it, but if we look over time, we can see how the sketch notes actually modify or change even a little bit over time as you learn things or try new things out. So
most definitely, yeah,
that makes it, that's, it's just like this endless game of trying things out and exploring and experimenting. So that's really great to hear, and I'm really proud of the work you've done at XOXO and representing the community, and I know that there's others who are also representing the community as well. And it's very satisfying for me, as someone who just sort of came up with this crazy idea, you know, a few years ago, and started experimenting with it, to see people really adopting it and sort of taking it and running with it. That's the most satisfying thing of all, is just seeing people enjoying it and making it their own, doing things I couldn't have imagined when I first started coming up with this crazy word to describe what seemed like something made sense and it seemed to fit. So that's, thank you for doing that and forwarding it even farther than I could have ever done it by myself.
Shucks. Thank you for not only coining the word, but also trying to bring a community around it. I think having other people who are doing sketch notes online and having a search term to look it up has been just a really great joy, to be able to find and stumble upon other people's work and have a term to a common language.
Well, that's cool. And I hope the term just, and the idea just keeps continuing, that in 100 years, our grandkids will listen to this podcast and think, oh, you know, great grandpa was one of the early people in sketchnoting, and people are still doing it today. And that's my hope, is that it will continue and sort of be this encouragement for people to draw and write and mix things together. So that's sort of my goal. We'll see. I'm not going to be here to see what that's like in years, but maybe my grandkids will be able to keep track of that. And that should be a lot of fun to see where it goes. So, but I'm not really sure where to transition after that one.
Yeah.
So we'll have a chuckle. And, I think what I want to step into now is, we talked a little bit, as we got going about, the tools that you use. So we always talk about tools on the show. So I think because you do so much analog, I'd like to have you start with the analog tools you use, if they're still the same cheap notebooks that you get at Walgreens or CVS, or if they've changed, and what kind of pens are you into right now? And then after that, if you are into digital stuff or you have thoughts on digital, jump right into that after that.
Okay. You can cut in or splice in the sound of me cracking my knuckles right here. I am still using the cheapest notebooks that I can find. I'll get a notebook that's usually a digest size, spiral bound. Sometimes I go to Staples or an office supply store. I usually customize them and put something on the cover of them to make them my own, and then cover the back of them with stickers from everywhere. It gives it a little bit more personality. And as soon as it feels like it's a little bit more lived in, there's the cheaper notebook and the lived in feeling make it more approachable to draw in. Mm. I tried starting with Moleskines, or however you pronounce the name, and they were just such perfect books that it was really, really hard to bring myself to make marks in them, because I was afraid of messing something up. And then they're, at least in the old days, they were pretty expensive, and especially as a grad student. So it was tough to justify that. So again, I totally vote for buying the $5 or less sketchbook at the drugstore on the corner. And for pens, the paper weight and the tooth, the roughness of the paper seems to vary between all of these. So I say find a pen that works for you, that is fast enough to write with, but doesn't bleed a lot into the paper and kind of stretch out, kind of like a bad tattoo. So my favorite pens at the moment are gel pens. I like to use the Pilot G2s, usually 05s or 07, I think, is what most of the colors come in standard. I just discovered, thanks to a friend of mine, Sean Garrity, who works for Newell Rubbermaid, the InkJoy brand from Papermate. Mm-hmm. They have a new gel, InkJoy gel, and it's really deeply satisfying to use. It just flows really smoothly, and so it's kind of been a contender against the G2s. The only problem is that it's hard to find the 0.5s unless you're going to an office supply store, but maybe they're online. And let's see. Oh, also the Sharpie pens, not the Sharpies themselves, but the Sharpie pens that are essentially budget pigment liners. I really like those for certain occasions, especially for colors. They seem to work pretty well. I've had some problems with the color gel pens drying up or just hitting a rough spot on the paper and not marking, especially as they get older. I don't know if I'm doing something wrong and not taking care of my pens well. I'm sure somebody will hear this and get all up in arms, and hopefully they can teach me some lessons.
Interesting. And so when you talk about the Sharpie pens, these are the small, thin,
yes,
they're sort of like a standard pen size. I think my buddy Brian likes those. And is it still the same permanent ink, or is it actually not a permanent ink pen?
I think it might be permanent ink,
okay,
but I don't want to bet the farm on that.
Okay.
It's definitely got kind of like a metal barrel with a felt tip at the end. So it's a lot like a Micron pen, but just a little bit cheaper.
Okay.
And more disposable. And they have medium, and then they also have fine, and they might have extra fine. Okay. But it works really well on the Moleskine pages, I've found.
And that's one brand or type of... I've used the regular Sharpies, you know, for signing books. I have these orange ones, and I've used the other ones for all kinds of things. I've not really explored that line of the pens, and I'm getting more into felt tip lately, so it's interesting that you're getting into gel, and I'm kind of getting out of gel. I still like gel pens, but the good old flare paper mates are actually very attractive lately. Yeah. So,
if you like the flares, I would say definitely check out the Sharpies. It's going to be a different tip. So
sure.
And now we're getting really nerdy about pens. I'm so glad you invited me on this podcast.
This is awesome. And I think everybody else is out there looking through the show notes or writing things down as they hear this too, because everyone's always on the search for the next new pen, and sometimes you stumble onto them by accident. And this hopefully will inspire some people to do some exploring with some new pens too.
I do also have to make a plug for JetPens. I don't know if you've had any other guests plug them, but JetPens.com sells a bunch of obscure Japanese pens, including brush pens and felt tip pens that are fantastic. My friends Derek Hunter and Ryan Otley turned me onto that. And I bought a Kuretake brush pen there that has actual bristles, and it's amazing. So highly recommend that.
Yeah, I think it's hard for an episode of this show to go by without a mention of JetPens, or on my newsletter that I do. Sooner or later, JetPens makes its way into it because they just do such a variety of stuff. And I've been, oddly enough, exploring JetPens. I found an old bristle pen of mine or a brush that I want to explore with ink. But that I should explore one of the Kuretake. I have the different kind that's a felt tip one.
Brush pen.
Yeah. So I just did a video series. It's not available yet, but it was fun to get the brush out and feel. You definitely have to think about it differently.
Oh yeah.
So that's kind of a fun something I had forgotten about for many years. So I think I want to get back into that and use those brush pens again and see. Maybe it'd be fun to do a sketch note with brush pens and see how would that change. Like, you would maybe not be able to get quite the detail. You would have to change your perspective and your approach, but it could be a fun challenge to do just for an experiment.
Yeah, I don't know how you would get the handwriting, but I write really, really small. But definitely for titles and drawing people. But actually, that segues really nicely into digital tools, how you were talking about how it changes the way that you draw. Mm-hmm. That was my experience when I first started using drawing tablets. I had always kind of had a ballpoint pen, kind of a Ligniclair style of drawing. But then when I switched to the pressure sensitive, the old school ArtPad Z, Wacom Graphires, and those, it kind of forces you to draw in a different style and adopt a more looser style. And every generation of technology that comes out with the styluses on the iPads, it's a completely different experience, I find, and very different from drawing with pen on paper. So we were talking about this a little bit before the show. Stop me if you wanted to interject with a little bit of guidance on this, but I have strong opinions about analog versus digital, and I love them both equally, but I feel like they are very different in a way that it almost exercises different parts of your brain. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, I've done some sketchnote style posters for conferences. I did a poster session for the IA Summit where I made a 4-foot by 3-foot poster in kind of a sketchnote style. And to do that, I found it was far easier to draw it on paper first and then scan it in and vectorize it than it was to, because I tried a few times, and the tools that I had that I was using, I just wasn't proficient enough in. And it was far easier to just draw something at scale on paper, scan it in, vectorize it with DragPotrace, I think, or Potrace, which is a tool that the artist Frendon has talked about quite a bit. And it's phenomenally fast, and it just vectorizes it in a snap, and then you can, sorry, I hit my pop filter, you can composite everything in a vector tool, and it makes it a whole lot easier to do.
That's really interesting perspective, because one of the tools that I started playing with, and I've paused right now, but I quite like, is called Concepts. And there's a pro version for the iPad Pro, which is, it sort of gives you the feeling of a ink pen in some sense, or as close as can be approximated with a iPad Pro and the pencil. But it's actually got vectors underneath. And I honestly think, and I wonder, like many of these pixel generated tools, like as an example, Paper by 53.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
the one that lots of people talk about. I find myself coming back to it because of the limitations. Like, initially, that was the frustrating part of it, was I couldn't choose my pen size, and I couldn't, there were some weird things about it. But as I've used it and forced myself to stay with the tool, I've actually found that those limitations are, you sort of adapt to them just like you would a cheap notebook or a felt tip pen, or, you know, how that thing acts. You sort of adapt yourself a little bit, which can be, you know, good or bad, I guess, depending on what you want to get out of it. But one thing I've liked about paper is it's probably the closest I've found to feeling like ink on pen, or, you know, ink on paper, because of those limitations, I think. But Concepts is another interesting tool because it's using those vectors. And my thought was, I think paper is actually using vectors in the back end too to capture the strokes and then just immediately pixelating them. So, and the only reason I think that is there's been cases where I've done very complex drawings and I wanted to share it, and it pops up this dialogue and you see this little spinner compiling or whatever it says.
Huh.
It's like, if I was drawing in pixels, why would you have to compile it? So yeah, there must be, you know, because remember they have to calculate however many number of undos backwards that they need to provide. I don't know how far back it would go. And so there's got to be
plot. So much easier with points on a vector line.
Yeah. And I think, you know, maybe it's actually going on in the background for the app to keep track of what's going on. But when it actually generates, it's not showing you that. You just see what you've drawn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's certainly limitations where Concepts, the whole mindset of the tool is a little bit different. It's everything is vector based. Everything that you've drawn, you can select and change. So you could do a whole sketch note and go in and say, you know what, I want it to look like I used a brush pen, and you'd select all those vector, you know, elements, and then switch your brush, and everything would immediately change, which is really interesting in the context to that poster you talked about, where maybe you could build it in pieces. But I think the other challenge, and I think Eva Lotta touched on this in a previous episode, was the weird thing for her, and I noticed this too in iPad stuff, is when you have the ability to scale things, you end up with really weird sketch notes. Because, like, you know, some things are actually bold and pretty big, and then for whatever reason, you slightly scale the piece. If you leave the pen tip at the same size, like if you tell the app don't size the tip of the pen, then the proportions seem a little wrong that way. But if you scale the pen tip thickness and you make it a little bit smaller, bigger, then that sort of seems, and it just sort of visually sort of seems janky or something. It's hard to describe what that is, but
it's this weird cognitive dissonance where you're looking at it and you can tell that it's been scaled with something that is not man.
Yeah, I think that's it. Yeah. Is we are really good at recognizing patterns, and so if we see something's a little bit off, it sort of throws up our radar and like, oh, okay, what else is going on? It's sort of like, you know, maybe I'm not so great at it, but I can usually tell when things have been photoshopped or tweaked because that's a tool that I use and I know what they can produce, or at least I have an idea. And you can pick up those things, and in some cases, maybe not all cases, but maybe the really good stuff is so seamless that you couldn't tell. But
that kind of stuff has been going on for years and years and years. Yeah. And there's a great book from some alumni of the CIA, I think, called Photo Fakery, on the history of Photoshop before Photoshop. And
interesting.
There's all these subtle little details that the brain picks up, everything from the lighting angle to the shadows on things and the ways that the seams of things that your brain will pick up and say, that doesn't look quite right if you're used to paying attention to it for a really long time.
Hmm. So maybe the next question would be is, since you have strong opinions about these, and I think in a lot of ways I agree. I think I look at the two tools, analog and digital, as two different tools. Like I've even written this before that I'm not going to give up pen and paper. I think they're too valuable to me. And I see the iPad Pro or whatever tool you might want to mention and as a technology alternative it's either an extension of it or it's providing something the paper and pen can't, like undos or whatever it is, right? It's an augmentation. It's not a replacement in my mind anyway. And it's, you know, if you think about it this way, like I can imagine how many cheap notebooks and pens you could buy for $1,000 that it would cost to get an iPad Pro and a pencil, right? That'd be like a lifetime supply for you, right? Literally.
I'm still using an old iPad 3, and my brother for Christmas got me a, uh, I think it was an Adonit Jot, one of the Bluetooth styluses that's pressure sensitive, and it's great. But the hardware is really showing its age. And I also got a copy of AstroPad, which is the software that lets you use your iPad essentially like a Cintiq.
Right.
And I should mention that before I actually owned a Cintiq for a while, I bought it when I had a lot of disposable income back at an agency job. And I thought that I was going to use it to draw so much, but it was still different from drawing on paper. There was a little bit of parallax difference because you're drawing on top of a sheet of glass. So it's like you're drawing with a pen on top of a sheet of glass, and the pen is somehow leaking through the glass to make marks underneath that. And there's a whole lot of registration and calibration that you have to do before you get started to make it feel natural. And even the fact that you're drawing on a screen versus drawing on a Wacom tablet in your lap makes a huge difference in making it feel a lot more real, as I'm guessing the iPad Pro or the Pencil does. But it's still something to, especially how fast I write handwriting. I haven't been able to find something that can replicate that smoothly.
That's interesting perspective. And I think I felt the same way about I got a used Cintiq from a friend, a 12-inch one, and thought I was going to use it. And then I got out of the box and realized with a laptop, I would have to replace the normal screen that I'd use, and wasn't very portable. There were wires everywhere. It seemed very stationary. Like, and then I ended up hardly ever using it, and it's now, you know, in a box, and it's just, should probably get it out for my kids to use. But the same kind of feelings, like it just felt a little bit clunky. And I have to say that the iPad Pro and the Pencil have achieved a level of quality, the next generation of that. I think probably the portability is a big part of it. I've modified it a little bit, so that whole idea of drawing on glass, it's a little bit of that with the iPad Pro stock. So I've actually put these matte screen covers on there.
Screen cover, yeah.
And it provides a little bit of a tooth, so it feels a little more like paper, and that all these little things seem to help a little bit. And then, you know, actually getting in and using it and sort of forgetting what getting to know the tool that I'm using really well and sort of forgetting and just getting into the actual action helps a lot. But I think it does in some ways impact what I can do, because I know I can make edits to it and I can move things around. So that's a little bit, you know, the mindset you go into it with is a little bit different than you would with pen and paper. So it's definitely a different, but I think it's it'd be really interesting to hear your perspective if you had a chance to use an iPad Pro for a little while, maybe tweaked out a little bit to make it as close to paper, and if you felt like the lag was, I don't particularly notice any lag, but you know, that's each person's got their own perspective. So
I'll have to go to an Apple store and check it out. My handwriting is really, really tiny, and I've been writing that way since ninth grade, so I've gotten really, really fast at writing very, very tiny handwriting, and old habits die hard. So as you said, with constraints, you kind of have to give yourself a constraint system and learn to use it within the ways that it was intended to be used to get the most out of it at first. And or maybe that's completely false. Maybe when you're discovering a system, it's good to just push the boundaries and go through the bad art vortex and see what all the things are that you can do with it that you shouldn't be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And the one thing that you did say that I did want to call out from before is that there, when I am drawing with pen and paper, I do find myself sometimes reaching for that Command Z to undo, and that is one reason why I would go digital over analog, is I make a lot of mistakes, and when I can't get used to them, or I make such a big mistake that I can't actually fix it, I usually have to cut out another piece of paper from my sketchbook, draw the fixes, and paste that on top. So
modified in Photoshop in the scan itself, right?
Yeah. I guess sometimes because I keep... Yeah, I do make modifications in Photoshop, but I've tried to modify the original as much as possible in a strange way. I don't know why, but there was one sketch that I did of someone at a conference and completely messed up this person's mouth. It looked really scary and horrific. And so I redrew the mouth on another piece of paper, kind of tracing over, and then taped it on top. And
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, and I think, when people listen to this show, hopefully they'll go and look at your work. And one of the things that I think I identify especially with your work is that you always, as far as I can tell, you always draw a portrait of the person who's speaking, which is not always the case for everyone. I know I've done it in the past, and I guess I've sort of fallen away from that, but I think that's an interesting thing that you do. And I really like your interpretations of people as well. I think it's, it adds something to it. And I think it's something unique about the sketch notes that you do that maybe not everyone does. I know Evilotta does it, in many cases, but not always. So that seems like, your trademark in some sense.
I don't always do it. Sometimes I run out of time, or sometimes it's just I'm sitting way too far back in the auditorium.
Not going to get a shot of that person's face enough to really represent them well. Interesting. Well, thank you for the perspective on digital. And I think, not everybody is totally on board with it yet. I know my friend Michael Clayton's got the iPad Pro. I haven't talked to him lately, but it seemed like there were still some hangups for him. It didn't exactly fit for him, and that may very well be the case for you. Even if it's better, it may still not be to the level. Evilotta mentioned it too in the discussion we had, that we spend all this time and effort to basically recreate what you can get at Walgreens for for $3, right, for like a year supply of this stuff, right? It's in some ways laughable that the technology has only gotten as far as recreating what was invented thousands of years ago or whatever. So that's
The technology will catch up eventually.
Yeah, it will.
But there's also a really good lesson in this, which I think you've hit on the head before, which is you don't need a lot of money to get started in this. It's a really, really cheap hobby to pick up, and there's nothing really holding you back.
And I think it's a lot of fun too to sort of stumble across like, oh, that's an interesting notebook. Why don't I just try it and see where I can push this thing? So as an example, I mentioned this, I think, in another one. The guys that make Field Notes, the Field Notes brand, they produced a limited edition one called the Byline, which they teamed up with a reporter, and they basically recreated that reporter notebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it was Penchalet reached out and said, hey, we got these bylines. Would you like to play with one and give us a review? I said, sure, send one over. I can't imagine why I would ever use it. And so they sent it over, and I started playing with it and found it really kind of cool to be limited to this long, narrow format with, lines, and ended up doing the review as a sketch note and putting it up. And then the Field Notes guys, who I know a little bit, reached out and said, hey, can we use your sketch note on our website? I was like, go for it. So there you go. I had no plans to use this thing, and I actually found it was useful. I had them in a hackathon and was writing down hex numbers for colors and notes and stuff. So, it turned out to be an interesting experiment that went differently than I had planned. Like, I had gone into it thinking, I'm never going to use this reporter style notebook. And in the end, I found that I quite liked it. The paper was really nice with particular pens I was using, and it was fun to be challenged. So I think that's an encouraging message there is, if you find a notebook that's cheap, pick it up and try it. Maybe, if it doesn't work, you can always just not keep using it, especially if it's really cheap, and see where you can push it. I think that's a lot of fun, is just seeing where you push things.
Definitely.
So
I was going to ask really quickly, maybe you mentioned this already, but the reporter notebook that you're talking about, did it have kind of a blank space at the top and then rule lines underneath, or was it all ruled? Or
I think it was all ruled. It had a
okay.
It's got like a gray cover, and it's actually spiral bound, but the cover actually covers the spiral, so you can stick it in your pocket without crushing it. it's got like
that
a little
really nice.
Like a little flap in the back, so you can like stick receipts and whatever in the back. The paper, I don't know, I can't remember what the paper was, but it's really super smooth calendar paper, so it's not a ton of tooth. So really works well for like flares and other felt tip pens laying on that surface. It's a really good at holding ink as well, so it's not going to bleed through. Probably the downside is they're not particularly cheap, although Field Notes books are in the scheme of like a Moleskine are probably a little bit less, but it's just a unique little thing that they fooled around with, and I think it's limited edition. So if you hear this and you're interested in this idea, you should probably go to Field Notes and see if they have any left, and or check with places like Pencilet or Jet Pens and see if they've got any, because I know that they're a limited run. I don't know when they're going to run out, so check those out for sure.
Will do. I know you're probably talking to the listeners, but
and I guess you are a listener too. So I think this is a great time to shift to the thing that we've been doing, I think, from about the middle of the first season into this season, and that is three tips. So what I do is I offer guests the opportunity to share three tips or suggestions or mindsets for sketchnoting, things that you would encourage someone. So let's assume it's somebody who's new to sketchnoting or someone who's just got into it. They're excited and they're at this next point, sort of the next climb up is mastering like layout and how to manage what to capture and space and all that kind of stuff. Like they're into it, but they feel like there's a little resistance and they want to keep going and they need a little bit of encouragement. And maybe think about what are the three things that you might share with someone like that to encourage them in their sketchnoting practice.
This is a tough one. Is it okay if all three tips are about drawing people?
Sure.
Okay. One of the tips was actually, thank you, it was in your sketchnote workbook. And that tip is using another color. And I like to sketch out people in the color first, because you can get really sketchy and just go really basic and make as many mistakes as you want and then go over it with black. And that kind of pulls the shape together. The second tip that I would say is try to break down the person's face into shapes. Like, I usually start with the nose and try to figure out what kind of shape the nose is and where the eyes are positioned to it, and then the shape of the head. Some people have somewhat squarish heads. Some people have trapezoidal heads. Some people have really oval heads. But it really helps to kind of just break these things. Stop looking at them as people, which I hate to say, but for a moment, let your eye just kind of relax and see them as the fundamental shapes that are making up their face and their body. And then I'd say the last thing is that even if you're a really fast sketcher, it's tough to sketch somebody at the same time that they're talking. And so I try to figure out when, as I'm listening to things, when there might be lulls or when I've captured enough of an idea that I could go back and fill it in later in the notes and then use that to sketch the person. I'll try to capture as much of kind of a rough organic outline of the person first and then fill it in as there's moments throughout the talk. And to do that is tricky because usually most speakers at conferences are pacing back and forth on a stage or they're turning to face different directions in the auditorium. And so my advice is either pick one position that they seem to be taking a lot or facing a lot and try to draw that. And then every time that they turn back to it, glance at them to make more notes in your drawing of the person, or cheat and pull out your camera at some point, usually at the beginning of the lecture or the talk, and snap a few pictures of them making different facial expressions or facing different ways. And then you can kind of use that image, those images to form a mental image of what they look like when you're figuring out what the shapes are that make them up.
Wow, that sounds like really deep pro tips, and especially the taking a pick is a really great tip that I use for sketchnoting food, because you know, food is important to eat. So I'll take a photo and I'll eat it, and then I'll come back and draw the stuff. So that's really encouraging. And I think so. Do you ever use? Here's a question I was thinking of as you talked about that. Have you ever used like online photos of people as a reference if you really just really couldn't get them and capture them live, or do you try to avoid that unless you have to?
I do, but when I draw them, I try not to imitate, I try not to directly copy somebody else's image when I'm drawing, which is just a personal thing. It's not ethical or anything. I just really kind of want it to be my own. So if I'm drawing somebody from a photograph, it's usually from a photograph that I've taken. And if I'm looking at a photograph of that somebody else has taken, I usually try to make kind of a mental 3D model of the person in my head and try to figure out, okay, if they're facing this way in that photo and their nose looks like this, then the way that I had started drawing them, the nose probably needs to look like this, or the eyes need to look like this. And so, and sometimes it's okay to put less detail in your images. I think Scott McCloud talked about this a lot in his book, Understanding Comics, but the more abstract, the more the mind fills in the details. And I find that usually I'm adding details until a point where it starts to not look like the person. And then I realize I've gone too far. So that's kind of something that you get used to, is just adding enough detail for it to still look kind of like a caricature of them, or yeah.
So in other words, don't overcook it, basically.
Definitely don't overcook it.
Which, you know, is a challenge too, because I've been in cases where I'm going to add a little more detail, and then it's like, oh, now I went too far. So I know that feeling, and I'm sure that others listening have probably felt that as well, right, where they just went a little bit farther and it was a little bit too far, and you just sort of laugh about it and try not to do it the next time. But that's interesting.
Especially are the trickiest part. I think that if you add too much detail in the wrong way on the eyes, it can really look like a completely different person.
And I think, it's helpful that you're giving these tips too, because I think so often, if you're doing this and you're fearful that you're going to get their face wrong, and now it's, you know, if you're using ink, now it's permanently on your page, right? There's just sort of this stay away feeling. Like, if I don't think I could pull this off well, I'm just going to stay away from it completely. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good practice, because you find yourself dealing with all these different things that maybe you're a little bit afraid of. And if you don't push yourself a little bit to try those things or put some limitations on yourself, you're just going to sort of end up in a similar space all the time. So I try to, and it sounds like you do this as well, you put some limitations, like you said, you try never to use somebody else's photo, you use your own, or you use that moment. Certainly no reason, like you said, ethically, that you couldn't do that. Nobody would ever know, and it doesn't really matter, but it's just a limitation you put on yourself. Is a fun, you know, it's another part of the game, right?
Yeah. Got to keep it interesting. And I think you also need to give yourself permission to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. And there's so many times where I've written in the notes, just in case, as I said, I do them for myself first, but just in case the person who gave the talk is looking at the notes, I'll write a little apology of, this is a really awful likeness. This looks nothing like the person. I'm sorry. but that just kind of makes my conscience feel a little bit better. But there are times where you are going to just totally mess up the likeness of a person, and it's okay. Just shrug and move on to the next one, or scratch through it, turn it into a drawing of something else, and draw another likeness of the person. Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah. Or cut it out of another page and tape it on top.
Exactly.
Of the one that's bad, right?
Exactly.
I would actually watch a video of you, like watching a video, and then just drawing people and seeing your technique actually unfold on camera. That would be really fascinating. So
if I can figure out a way to use my iPhone wedged onto some kind of document camera stand, yeah, I'll see if I can get that working.
Yeah, that's not a challenge or anything, but it's just an observation. It would be fun to see. And maybe that's the next step for the podcast, is providing some videos and visuals for people to follow as an augmentation to the discussion. So, man, this has been a fantastic discussion, and
thank you so much.
I think
it's been a pleasure and an honor.
It's I think it's about the time in the show where we share the places where people can find you, because I hopefully will see some people reaching out and saying hello, and definitely looking at your work. You do such fantastic work, and the style is so unique. I think it's just a treat to check it out. So why don't you share a little bit about where people can most find you, the places you're most active, and your handles in those places, and websites, and all that kind of stuff. We'd love to check it out.
Okay. I'm just some guy on Twitter. I'm literally just some guy on Twitter. And that's probably where I'm the most active. I post most of my conference sketch notes there. I'll snap a picture as soon as I get them done, hopefully during the conference itself. When I get a chance, I'll scan the sketch notes in and clean them up in Photoshop and post them to my Flickr account. I'm Jay Alderman on Flickr. And I also have a tiny letter, which I just started, and that's probably the other place if you're interested in the same kind of wild, varying things. And it's tinyletter.com/excitedtobehere. And each email newsletter is just something crazy that I'm excited about. Everything from recurrent neural networks to how to make pizza to... I think the most recent letter was about my process of turning sketch notes into a poster.
Wow. That sounds like something fun to see coming in from you each time you send one out. And,
It's pretty infrequent. It's usually once a month, so I won't spam your inbox with lots of things, but
well, and that's good to hear. Cause I think, right now it's really popular for people to have newsletters and to send stuff out weekly, which I guess, in some cases is great. I try to aim for about every 2 weeks. So every month is kind of nice as well. It's sort of alternates from what the standard is. And I'm sure, that'll be something fun for folks listening to sign up for and get some messages from you. So thanks so much, Jason, for making time and
hanging out.
This has been really fantastic. And, I just so appreciate you, sharing your thoughts and giving us another voice in the sketchnoting community to encourage people and inspire people to just keep going and keep practicing.
Thank you again for having me. It's been great, and I really hope that I see lots of sketch notes from all your listeners, because that's one of the things that gives me the greatest joy, is seeing other people's sketch notes.
Well, fantastic. And I'm going to close the show with that. So thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to support the show, definitely go to iTunes and leave us ratings. Purchase my books, of course. That's a great way to do it. And right now we've got some Sketchnote Army wear that you can go check out, sweatshirts and t-shirts. We're going to continuously run those for you. So if you want to pick up gifts for Christmas or for yourself, that's something you can check out as well. So go to sketchnotearmy.com/t-shirts to support the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Sketchnote Army Podcast.